the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order, and we're going to start with Senator Torres Reyes' bill.
Oh, good. We're doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm here to ask for your support for Senate File 1221, which is a bill from the Department of Human Services about child welfare, and I have several provisions that will be amended in this bill. Most of this language that will be presented today is intended to be used for compliance with federal regulations, and I have four amendments, Madam Chair, that I would like to introduce. And the reason we have so many is because we had several recommendations that came to my office that are related to the bill. Three of them are very related. One is not, but it is a DHS responsibility. So I would like to present those amendments before so that we can put the bill in the shape that we need in order to have the presentation. So the first one is the A3 amendment, which will address recommendations that resulted from discussions between the Minnesota Indian Tribes and the Department when the recently amended tribal-state agreement was negotiated. It ensures compliance with federal requirements that the courts regulate, which address consulting with adolescents when addressing issues relating to their care. And that's the A3 amendment. I believe you have this before you right now.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. Why don't we just take them all as one motion since they're all author's amendments?
Okay. Thank you. The second one is the A4 amendment, Madam Chair and members of the committee, which is intended to protect earnings from a child who is placed in foster care and is working. The next one is the A5 amendment, which is a technical amendment that was introduced by the department. And the A6 amendment, which will extend a pilot program for 2 years for long-term care for elderly and disabled persons.
Four, five, six.
So that constitutes the four amendments that I would like to introduce to the bill this afternoon.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. So we have amendment A3, A4, A5, and A6.
That's correct, Madam
Chair. Would you like to move those as one motion?
You like me to move them?
Yes.
I move that we adopt amendments A3, A4, A5, and A6 into Senate File 1221.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the author's amendments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Thank you. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I now would like to call some members of the department who will be helping me present this bill, and also would like to have additional testifiers who will be presenting to the committee their support for some of the amendments that we have related to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Thank you. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at the Department of Human Services. What I will do is quickly walk you through this, the bill section by section. This bill primarily deals with assuring that children who cannot live with their families have opportunities for permanency, and so we see a couple of changes in the area of adoption. And the bill also, as Senator Torres-Ray indicated, will help us come into compliance with respect to new federal requirements pertaining to children either entering or leaving Minnesota for purposes of foster care and adoption, as well as a couple of other provisions that I will go through. Section 1 of the bill simply allows tribes to participate in the current public-private adoption initiative. Currently, the department contracts with private child placing agencies to help counties find adoptive families for children who are wards of the state. And this would simply allow tribes to respond to our request for proposals and be a part of that process as well. Section 2, Section 6, and Section 15 deal with 14-year-olds where there's been a termination of parental rights and they are wards of the state. These sections would continue to require that the adolescent be given the opportunity and the right to consent to an individual adoption, but the child would not be able to waive the agency's continuing responsibility to find an adoptive family for that child, and would ensure that the child is able to be placed on the state adoption exchange. But again, the child would have to ultimately consent to any adoption, but it requires the agencies to continue their efforts to find permanency. Sections 3 and 4 of the bill simply deal with the timing of petitions when the court administrator's office sends petitions for adoption or adoption decrees to the department for purposes of record retention. Section 5 simply allows funding for adoption recruitment efforts to be made at an earlier point in time in the case so that children with special needs have the opportunity to have adoptive families found for them. Section 6, as I indicated, corresponds to the proposed change to Section 2 regarding the 14-year-olds, and this would allow for the 14-year-olds to be entered on the state adoption exchange. Section 7 of the bill is required under federal law in the recently passed Safe and Timely Interstate Placement Act for Children, and this section requires that counties look for homes both in the state as well as out of state when they're looking at permanent homes for children who cannot be returned to their families. Section 8 and Section 9 of the bill deal with jurisdiction of Indian tribes for children who are residing or domiciled on the reservation and application of the Indian Child Welfare Act. These provisions were slightly amended with the A3 amended amendment that you adopted a few minutes ago. Section 10 of the bill also deals with the interstate placement of children and would make us consistent with the new federal requirements. This section also allows for the receipt of incentive funds if home studies are completed within 30 days. The new law will require that studies be completed in 60 days and in some instances 75 days, but there is an opportunity for incentives if the studies are completed sooner, and this section would allow for that and the redistribution of incentive funds based on agencies that earn them. Section 11 of the bill would provide foster parents, pre-adoptive parents, and relative caregivers with the right to be heard at court proceedings involving children in their care. In the past, that had been an opportunity to be heard, but with the new federal law, those individuals are now to be given a right to be heard at the court hearings. Section 12 of the bill is also a federal requirement and deals with trial home visits. A couple of years ago, you passed legislation which would allow for trial home visits for children moving from foster care back with their families. At the time, we did not count the trial home visits for purposes of the permanency time clock, which is the period of time agencies must work to establish permanency for children. Under the federal regulations, that time during a trial home visit is to be counted toward permanency. But this would also allow, if a 12-month permanency hearing was required for a child on a trial home visit, the court could continue that trial home visit so it would not be disrupted. Section 13 and 14 of the bill also are federally required. Section 13 simply modifies the out-of-home placement plan to include child-specific recruitment efforts and the most recent health and education records in that plan, and also requires that the county or the agency provide a copy of the foster child's health and education record to the child's parent, adoptive parent, or legal custodian. And Section 14 requires that the agency provide those records to a child aging out of the foster care system. Section 15 of the bill corresponds to the earlier sections regarding the 14-year-olds who are state wards, and this would eliminate a current affidavit that a child can sign at age 14 declining adoption. Sections 16, 17, and 19 deal with clarifying responsibility for conducting maltreatment assessments or investigations, and simply clarifies that county agencies are responsible for conducting assessments or investigations involving allegations of abuse or neglect within the family unit, and law enforcement is responsible for conducting investigations involving alleged perpetrators outside of the family unit. and Section 18 of the bill was deleted in the A3 amendment that you adopted.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton. Senator, do you have any additional witnesses?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I wanted to point out that I was very excited to participate in this and to help the department move this bill, because I was approached by the tribes with some language for compliance with Indian Child Welfare, and Ms. Sullivan helped me figure out how we can put this language together so that we could do this together. So I really would like to point out that the department has been cooperating with the tribes to present a unified voice here. So that was very helpful to us. And I have two members of the tribes who wish to testify for here.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is George Gagalay, Jr. I'm the chairman for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And my testimony is going to be very short, and it's on behalf of the tribes, the Indian Affairs Council, and the Leech Lake Tribe, that we support the bill, the efforts that have been undertaken by this hardworking group of people, and we ask for your support in ensuring that this passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gagalay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andrew Small. I'm from St. Paul. I'm here to either answer questions or go through each of these sections that deal with the clarifications to the definitions that make them compliant with the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I can walk through those, or I'll be happy to answer questions.
Yes, why don't you walk through those briefly with us?
Thank you. In the amendments that you just passed in Section 8, Subdivision 12, Subdivision 1, begins with Indian tribe jurisdiction. That's a very, very critical element of the federal act, and it has three areas that allow for exclusive tribal jurisdiction. And when this legislation was originally passed in 85 as an oversight, it overlooked the domicile of an Indian child, and that is as critical as the residence or whether or not a child is a ward of a tribal court. So that's been added back in, and that makes it compliant with the federal law, Section 8, Subdivision 1. Section 8, Subdivision 12 is a minor clarification, but very important relative to how one identifies an Indian tribe. It had imposed a qualification on the federal definition, as you see, where it said, and exercising tribal governmental powers. There is no such test in the federal act, and there's no discretion granted to state courts to make an evaluation of how tribes may be exercising authority or not exercising authority. The same thing in Section 9, Subdivision 20, in the definition of tribal court. There had been a qualification placed on that meant a federally recognized court with federally recognized jurisdiction. There, again, is no such qualification in the federal law. Typically, there are federally recognized tribes, but their courts are an inherent part of their makeup and are not required to be federally recognized unless they're in a contractual relationship or something.
Mr. Small?
Yes.
I'll just remind you that this committee has already adopted all of the amendments as author's amendments, so we don't need to go over them, in great detail, but just briefly, if there is something of particular interest that the committee needs to know.
Apologize.
Thank you.
The only thing that I would want to point out is Section 9, Subdivision 2, where it says court determination of a child. This is an addition to the bill that is wholly apart from anything that we've discussed, and it is a matter that allows for full compliance with the act so that there can't be a discretionary determination made about how a child looks or how the child acts or whether or not that child can speak his or her tribe's language. the definition in the Federal Act says you're a member or eligible for membership and therefore entitled to the protections, and this makes that possible.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Small. Does the committee have any questions for any of Senator Torres Rey's testifiers? Any questions for the senator on her bill? Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If you don't have any more questions, I would like to recommend Senate File 1221 to be included in the omnibus bill.
As amended,
To be included in the Human Services Omnibus Bill.
To Judiciary.
Oh, it has to go to Judiciary. Then to be moved to Judiciary.
Okay. Thank you. Any discussion on the Senator's motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Yes.
Senator Berglund, welcome to the table. You have Senate File 967 for us today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I do have an amendment. It's an A2 amendment that I'd like to move to the bill.
Do we have that amendment?
To the packet.
The amendment is in the packets.
Would you like me to go through the amendment?
That's fine.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the amendment adds criteria to the public interest review law and alternative approval process that is used by the Minnesota Department of Health to considering cases where an applicant is an existing hospital. It would then ask the department to look at the ability of an applicant to maintain the current level of community benefit at the existing hospital, the impact on the existing workforce, and the commitment of the applicant to moderate any negative impacts on employees. We did have earlier this year a report from the Department of Health that looked at community benefit versus the not-for-profit tax status of hospitals in general. And this bill originally started out looking at trying to get a definition for us to continue to collect that information over time. And the amendment pairs it back just to looking at the issue of the new hospital in Maple Grove that would be built. It really was not clear to me at the time that we passed that law that there would be considerable downsizing of the facility in Robbinsdale, bordering North Minneapolis, that there would be considerable layoffs at that facility in order to get the capital needed to invest in the new facility in Maple Grove. And now that it's clear, this bill would simply ask the Commissioner of Health to review that situation in regard to the license before the license is provided for the facility in Maple Grove.
Is that right?
And would give the employees then that are being laid off at the existing facility an opportunity to be employed at the second facility so that they don't end up without jobs at all. And I have some folks here to testify on the bill, but maybe we should adopt the amendment first since it does take out a large part of the existing bill.
Okay. Good idea, Senator. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I did move it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee on the amendment? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion carries.
So maybe we could hear from the testifiers then. I have Holly Roden.
Okay, Ms. Roden.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Holly Roden. I am a senior researcher with the Service Employees International Union. And what I'd like to do is have Lori Tyne Bush give a statement first, and then I just have a couple of comments to make after her statement, if that is okay with the
Yes,
chair.
Thank you.
Good
Welcome
afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Tyne Bush, and I work as a phlebotomy EKG tech at North Memorial for the past 20 years or more. I think it's like 21 now. I love my job, and I love working with the patients. When North Memorial asked us to support their bid to get the hospital in Maple Grove, I was glad to lend a helping hand by signing their petition and getting others to sign it. Part of that willingness was knowing it would be North Memorial that was opening a new hospital, and employees from North would now have a second hospital in Maple Grove that they could transfer over to and work at. For many of us, this is closer to home, and it would not, and we would not have to give up the years that we spent building up seniority and other benefits that at North. But unfortunately, North is going back on its word, and we are compelled to take action. North Memorial says that the new hospital would be a separate corporation altogether. If we do move to the new hospital, we would have to quit our jobs and be rehired at North. And this would mean we would have to entirely start over at new employees. So all the seniority, the 21-plus years of service that I've given to North would now be lost. But the bigger issue here is what is going to happen to North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale. North originally said that if another company got the hospital, the medical center could not survive the competition. They said that they could use the new hospital to help sustain North Memorial Medical Center, which serves at-risk community at Robbinsdale and North Minneapolis. But now, they have changed what they are saying. They are establishing a separate company. So what has changed? How can North Memorial Medical Center, a hospital that employs as many workers as it does, survive under these circumstances? This isn't only about the Maple Grove Hospital. This is about the thousands of patients who obtain care every day at North Memorial Medical Center, patients who are at risk for losing much-needed access to health care in their communities. Taking care of our patients is our number one priority, but North Memorial is putting our hospital, their employees, and their patients at risk. This is why we're here today to support the Hospital Accountability Act, HF 1078. This legislation will help to make sure that North Memorial lives up to the commitment that they made to their employees, the community, and the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thiem Bush. Okay, and you want to make a comment again?
Yes, just, Madam Chair, just a couple of comments. The staff has just handed out a packet of material that I just want to go over briefly. Just to back up the testimony of Ms. Bush, if you'll look at Exhibit 1, which talks about the public interest review for proposed inpatient hospital, it was not just the workers at North Memorial that were under the impression that they would be transferred out to the new facility. If you look at the comments, these are excerpts from the Department of Health's report. They also clearly understood from the public interest review documentation that Robbinsdale, that North Memorial would transfer staff to its new Maple Grove facility. What's important about that language is that by transferring staff, they would no longer be in a competitive, very tight labor market to attract staff. And if you compare that to what the department raised in concerns for the Fairview and the TRICARE proposals at the time, you can see the scarcity of staff, the tightness of the market was a concern for how this facility would be staffed. On another point that Ms. Bush brought up, if you look at Exhibit 2, on the issue of sort of dire consequences for Robbinsdale, the Robbinsdale facility, again, these are directly taken from North Memorial's public interest review documentation. And it says, in as many different ways as it can say it, that without a cross-subsidization from the Maple Grove facility to Robbinsdale, the Robbinsdale facility's actual existence would be at risk. Our understanding is that the proposal that North and Fairview put forward now is, as it was phrased to us, is that Maple Grove money will stay in Maple Grove, which means that they're not planning on cross-subsidizing back to the Robbinsdale facility. Our concern is that all of these dire consequences will indeed play out. The report that we gave you, the only thing I want to draw your attention to is on page 9. There are a couple of graphs that just talk about the different payer mixes between the communities that are going to continue to be served by Robbinsdale versus the new Maple Grove facility. And the only point being that, again, the concern that North raised initially and that we are still concerned about is that as the better insured, higher income people use the Maple Grove facility, it's going to leave a facility at Robbinsdale that's going to be servicing more racially diverse, lower and moderate income people with less stable insurance, which is a problem for any hospital to be able to continue to thrive. We know that there's going to be testimony following, and I think committee members have already heard this, the concern about bonding and the concern that this bill, now that it's pending, will have on bonding. The last thing I want to draw your attention to is a table of contents that I provided to you. This obviously isn't from North's bonding, but it's from a Fairview 2005 bonding document. And I would have given you the entire document, but as you can see, it's really thick, and I know you all want to read as little as possible at this point in the session. But the reason that I give it to you is that there are 30 pages of issues that are of concern to investors when they look at these bonds. Issues about what happens to Medicare reimbursements, issues that happens to what Medicaid reimbursements, issues that happen around any legislation that's pending in a state that could affect the viability of the hospital. For instance, I know that there's been bill introduced that would create the idea of a medical home, and this is a proposal that we also support, the idea being you provide more primary and preventative care. There will be less need for hospitalization. Now, I haven't sat in at every committee that's heard these bills, but I don't remember seeing representatives from either the hospitals themselves or the bond council that have been before the committees saying, please don't pass this bill because you're potentially jeopardizing the future financial viability of our hospitals by keeping people out of them. And I wonder what the committee's response would be if indeed they did that. Now, I know this particular language is specific to the issue of licensure, but again, all we're asking is the same level of commitment and the same standard that the investors are going to hold this new corporation to. The investors look at this bonding document and say, before they invest, can we believe that they're going to do what they said they're going to do? That is only the commitment that we are asking for in Senate File 967, is that the people that count on the Robbinsdale facility have that same commitment, that indeed the people building the new hospital are going to do what they said they were going to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rodan.
Senator? Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that it's really disconcerting to me, because when the folks were in front of the legislature, and I realize a number of you weren't here then, it was clear that they said that they should be the ones selected because of their Robbinsdale North Minneapolis facility. And then the second thing that's happened is they have closed whole units and laid off many employees at that facility, which one can only assume is to generate the revenue they need to sell the bond at the second facility. Then to find out that the second facility is going to be a separate corporation, not even linked to the first facility, is pretty disturbing to me.
Senator Berglund, thank you for that explanation. And I have a question for you. And just trying to get my mind around what happened in a previous session and what agreements were made, and then now what's before us, does this seem to you to be rather a bait-and-switch kind of situation? They came with one plan to a previous legislature, were given permission based on the the factors put before you at that time, they were given permission, and now they've completely switched what their plan is. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Well, they've switched what they portrayed the situation to be if they were the ones selected to have the license. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee at this point for these witnesses?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Roden. I assume there's two issues that you're talking about. One is the movement of the employees from one facility to the transfer. The other is the issue of losing business. Now, is there one that's preferable to the other? Because it seems to me that if you move employees from one facility to the other, you still have the problem of losing business, and even more so complicated because now you've lost half of a very trained staff. Which one is more important to you?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl,
Ms. Roden.
I would like to think that it doesn't have to be an either or. I mean, part of the original proposal that was put forward was the idea that North Memorial was going to right-size Robbinsdale. They were going to do single rooms. They were going to transfer beds from Robbinsdale out. So it was basically going to be a zero-sum game in that sense. There'd be, additional access to health care for Maple Grove, but there would still be a solid base of access at the Robbinsdale facility. Our concern now is that with the announcement that there's going to be a completely separate facility, and more importantly, that the money is not going to cross-subsidize back, we're afraid that we potentially lose on both sides of that, the question that you posed.
Okay. Madam Chair, so if I'm understanding this correctly, that there was supposed to be a cross-subsidy from the beginning that was part of the original discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Dahl, that certainly was a representation that North Memorial gave to the legislature as to why they should be selected to build this second facility in a much more prosperous community, was that it would be financially, it would make the North Memorial Hospital more financially viable.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for a senator or these two witnesses? Thank you very much. We'll go on to, there are some witnesses who are here to speak in opposition. Pat Cooksey and Cheryl Strait. Senator Limmer. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm State Senator Warren Limmer. I represent northwest suburbs of Hennepin County, where the new hospital is located, will be located. The reason I'm kind of barging in on your witness list is that between myself and Senator Berglund, we probably are the two eminently qualified historians of the hospital bill that led to the placement of a Maple Grove hospital, the very first competitively driven hospital request ever since the moratorium process first began. That's why it was rather unique. We had to come back to the legislature to consider whether or not new beds were needed and in a new facility. Almost over the previous 18 years, many members may recall that we added beds, which needed legislative approval, to existing facilities. But this one was the very first one where it was no hospital there. The health department had recognized the need and that a new hospital was placed in the northwest suburban area for a siting request. Public hearings were held. A rather spirited and competitive process began for 3 years. And if any of you ever have the opportunity to have three competitive corporations try and grab hold of the hospital or the ability to be considered as the hospital of choice, run, because it's very competitive. It pits neighbor against neighbor, community against community, and I don't welcome it for anyone to go through. Nevertheless, the Maple Grove and surrounding northwest suburban area did come together from a community collective, they recognized one of the major hospitals that had kind of served the area from a loosely defined marketing perspective, and that was North Memorial. As a result of legislative action, instead of just granting the opportunity to place a corporation into that area, the legislature took a little different route. We in the Senate held out to recognize the need for specific services that reflected the needs of our community, the population, perhaps the changing demographic that would come out. If any of you live in an outer ring suburb, you realize that those areas are always demographically profiled by young families, the need for pediatrics, need for obstetrics, the growing need for mental health beds that were recognized as a regional concern of the state. There were a number of other concerns as well. Senior citizens certainly will be on our marketing profile for any hospital and any critical health asset, such as what would be considered in Maple Grove. And so of the 23 specific criteria that were recognized, 17 were recognized to be placed in the Maple Grove Hospital bill. As a result, the market had to react. North Memorial joined with Fairview in recognizing the need for this criteria. And that's why you have now the combination of North Memorial Fairview as the corporations that were to be merged corporatively in order to provide the much-needed hospital in the Maple Grove area. Some of the demographics that you may need to know about, and I'll just briefly touch on them because that's not really critical for this discussion, but the Met Council has recognized that in the next 12 to 15 years, the metropolitan area will grow by roughly 1 million new people in the Twin Cities area. The need for infrastructure and the critical health-related assets that represent hospitals, ambulatory care, are certainly going to be needed as that population grows. This is Maple Grove is probably a little bit of the front hospital that will be considered in that wave of new health-related infrastructure, but nevertheless, it's still in process. One thing that I'd like to point out, and Madam Chair, you raised the question about whether or not there was a bait and switch. I have to disagree with that argument. That type of contention can best be seen in what legislation we passed. We passed a bill. We recognized the need of the needed health criteria services for that hospital. It was reflected in the bill. On the side of the bill was the roughly 21 communities surrounding and representing the northwest suburban area and further points out that would might be in that general service area. Those political subdivisions, the cities, city council members, mayors, chambers of commerce, all thought that this bill, the combination of North Memorial and Fairview, would be the ideal candidate to be located there. The city of Maple Grove also put out a resolution after their review saying that they would prefer that. As we began to look forward and look at the services that were recognized in that early legislation, we've reviewed as it progressed. We've seen the plans. The Department of Health was included in the considerations. They have to review the corporate plans of how that corporation is going to meet the needs that the legislature put forward. And I see nothing in the study of what has gone on to reflect any diversion from what state law was made and passed a year and a half ago. That bill took close to 3 years of public discussion and legislative discussion. It took 15 months of very concentrated, lively discussion, sometimes bitter at times and sometimes jovial. But nevertheless, the community and the state, I think, merged the best plan forward. I see nothing in the history of what went on from the passage of that state legislation to today that would reflect that there's anything different than what we gave the charge of that those corporations to go forward on. There's representatives here that can speak on behalf of the corporate accusations that have been made earlier today. And if you want to expand your questioning, feel free to bring these representatives forward.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Questions or responses? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, wouldn't it be fair to say that as the proposal went through the legislature and at all stages of the discussion of it, that everyone believed that the North Memorial campus and the Maple Grove campus would be run by the same organization and would be that the Maple Grove Hospital would be an expansion of the North Memorial facility?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, as I recall, the discussion with or the discussion that ensued reflecting the need to make sure that North Memorial was a preserved as much as intact healthcare asset for that region of North Memorial, Robbinsdale, and surrounding area was critical to the discussion, and that that same North Memorial Corporation was going to merge their efforts with Fairview in order to create that new hospital in Maple Grove.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
And Senator Limmer. So now when we learn that the new hospital is going to be a separate corporation, not in any way connected to North Memorial, and that employees have been laid off, units have been closed at North Memorial, which one can only assume is for generating the revenue necessary to sell the bond for the Maple Grove facility, wouldn't you say that that would be surprising to those of us who heard all the testimony from North Memorial for years and years about how it was going to stabilize the financial situation for North Memorial?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, in the course of the corporate history, many things change. I don't know the motive of or of the action of what North Memorial has done. I don't follow their corporate decisions. I am a state legislator. I don't get involved in their corporate business. These questions will have to be asked to the corporate representatives here. But nevertheless, I can't give you any conclusion to your comment about whether they're doing something with the motive of enhancing some type of bond rating. I don't know. I'm not informed on that. The only concern that I have is that our hospital in the northwest suburban area is not hindered in any way in progress. And if there is concern, I would suggest you ask those corporate questions to the corporate representatives here in the room today.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berland.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, since you have come before this committee, to make sure that they have the full and complete historical perspective on what happened. Do you remember getting letters from people that live in Maple Grove who work at North Memorial indicating they would like to have North Memorial be the hospital selected because then they would have the opportunity to work at the hospital in Maple Grove?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer, and as you respond, I know that you're looking at Senator Berglund. Make sure that you're also speaking into the mic. Thank you.
I'm of the habit of looking at people when I talk with them.
Right.
But Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, yes, I do remember that.
And so, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, would it be perhaps out of line then to assume that maybe some of the people that supported the North Memorial proposal in the legislative process believed that the constituents they were hearing from would actually have a chance to be transferred to the new facility without losing seniority or benefits or anything like that?
Madam Chair, there was public discussion, Senator Berglund. There was public discussion, as Senator Berglund has reflected, of employees from North Memorial attempting to influence the decision of the legislature, just as there were other employees of other hospital systems trying to influence us to recognize their particular corporate employer. That's rather common in this type of discussion. I would imagine one could only assume that employee benefits, packages, pensions, that type of thing would be in the same labor unit and that things would transfer. I don't remember having that particular defined conversation in this committee or any of the other three or four other committees that this bill went through.
Okay. Madam Chair,
I think
Senator Limmer has helped me to make the case that what exactly is happening is not exactly what we envisioned during the legislative discussions about the new hospital.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, we've heard accusations that North Memorial is closing units, laying people off. I'm not sure if that has really occurred. I'm not sure if a layoff is a layoff for any other reason than something else. We haven't defined that, if there are layoffs. I'm not here to speak on behalf of any corporation. When I presented the bill and chief authored this bill, I told the public as well as this body that I had no corporate favorites, that I was working on behalf of the community, trying to recognize the community services or the hospital services that would be necessary to address the needs of my immediate public, not only in the near future, but for the life of the hospital, as best we could figure out with our limited perspective. And we kind of looked out 20 to 30 years. The corporations are going to have to answer those questions. I'm ill-prepared to answer anything about a corporate accusation that was made here today.
Thank you, Senator. I think you've reassured the committee several times that you do not speak for the corporation, and we'll redirect our corporate questions to them when they come to the table. You have other witnesses here today. Pat Cooksey, would you like to? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before, and I do want to hear from the witnesses, but from the author of the bill and perhaps Senator Limmer as well, in the history of this whole thing, my question is the issues that are presented by the bill before us, the Senate File 967, are these issues that were discussed, brought up, topic of discussion during the process to allow the moratorium bill that eventually was passed? I mean, were these part of the conversations and were determinations made, and are we now, I guess, and Senator Berglund, you know, I was not part of this committee last year and was not very close to what the details of how this was going on. I'm just trying to understand, are these issues that have been dealt with before and are now coming back, or are these a whole set of new issues, and how does that fit into the overall process of dealing with the moratorium as a whole?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, one of the things that was very clearly discussed was the uncompensated care. If North had not been the facility that had been selected, they felt that it was only fair that there not be uncompensated care shifted to the North Memorial facility because somebody else would be operating a facility in an adjacent community. It was one of the things we discussed, and it was one of the things that was placed into the law in regard to the new facility. But in the discussion of that, North Memorial was using the uncompensated care policy and the amount of uncompensated care they provide at their North Memorial site. Now if we have a completely separate corporation running the facility in Maple Grove, whatever they do at their North Memorial site for uncompensated care obviously is not relevant. So that's just one area. Obviously, I've already indicated that, of course, everybody thought that it would be a second hospital that would be part of the two hospital organizations and that the employees would be able to be interchanged. In fact, you know, the discussion about the emergency room at North Memorial. They have a level one trauma emergency room. Discussion was, would it stay at the North Memorial site? And would people from Maple Grove then be referred to the trauma unit at North Memorial? And the answers to those questions were yes. It would stay at that site, and the patients would be referred to that site. That all led us to believe that it would be two hospitals that would be owned by the same organization.
And Madam Chair,
to that point,
there's nothing in the current legislation that would prohibit the kind of governance or corporate structure that has been proposed, I assume. I mean, if in the course of the discussion about last year about this bill and how the hospital, there may have been lots of thoughts and ideas and things talked about, but there was nothing in the law that said, well, the governance structure has to be XYZ. In other words, is the law permissive of whatever has apparently transpired?
Member Chair and Senator, you're right, there's nothing in the law about that because it never occurred to anybody that it would be an issue.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator, yes,
go
ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, you referred to the Level 1 Trauma Center issue. Is it going away if the new hospital is built, or is it going to remain at the Robbinsdale location?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I don't know. I know what the representations were made about it at the time, but, of course, the legislation itself doesn't really specify what has to happen to the trauma center.
Senator Berglund, I think that a hospital has to go through an awful lot of hoops and regulations to achieve a level one, and I don't know that any facility would give that up or that they'd be able to transfer it because this is a new facility. They haven't proven themselves. They can't just all of a sudden be a level one. That I don't think that's transferable. And I don't think North Memorial Robbinsdale would be willing to give it up.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I am just using that as an example of a discussion that took place that would have led everybody to believe that these two hospitals were going to be operated by the same organization, a partnership between North Memorial and Fairview, rather than a new separate corporation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
And now that we're on the discussion of level one, though, I think it does transfer to an earlier piece of the conversation when one of the testifiers said that something to the effect that there would be a lower level of patient with less insurance. There's only a few level one hospitals in the state of Minnesota, and I think the people directed at the North Memorial Trauma Center are going to continue to go there. Sometimes they come from South Dakota, North Dakota, and the surrounding states directly into that facility, and I think they would not lose those patients. So I'm not so sure that that was a good argument that the level or type or insurance type or whatever the argument was would actually decrease.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, it is very clear that the Robbinsdale facility that borders on North Minneapolis has a lot more uninsured people that they serve than a new facility in Maple Grove will have. And so, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I think the statements that were made in relationship to the fact that the legislature was told that North Memorial needed to be the chosen facility for Maple Grove in order to stabilize and make sure in the future there would be financial viability to the North Memorial facility. Now, if they're two separate organizations, two separate entities, those representations would not be fulfilled, and I think that's what the statements that were made were about.
And Madam Chair, I guess my point is that's there now, that will be there in the future, but then to go with your conversation is hopefully we'll have some testimony from North Memorial talking about if they're going to split entities or what they intend to do with
right.
their corporation.
And Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, just so you understand, there is a level one trauma center at Hennepin County Medical Center also.
Right.
So it isn't like the trauma center at North is the only place there is one in that area.
Right.
Thank you. I think we'll move on to Pat Cooksey, who is with North Memorial.
Madam Chair, excuse me, my name is Pat Buran. I wasn't on the witness list. I wasn't planning on testifying, but based on the discussion so far, I would like to. I am the Chief Financial Officer at North Memorial Healthcare, and I'm also the Treasurer of Maple Grove Hospital Corporation. And initially, I was here to testify on my concerns related to the uncertainty that this bill creates with regard to issuance of a license and how that will affect the financing that we are currently right in the middle of. And but as all the discussion occurred, I thought I could respond to some of the questions that have come up. The first thing, there's a great deal of discussion that spanned over 3 years regarding who committed what and how we're going to do the Maple Grove Hospital. The key element, as Senator Limmer referred to, was the fact that when we initially pursued the hospital in Maple Grove as an independent hospital, we failed. We did not get the votes to get the moratorium exception for that. And as a result of that, moved on to a partnership with Fairview that I think has been fantastic, and created a partnership that was successful in getting the moratorium exception passed. The key on that is you now have two corporations, two major hospital corporations, coming together to form a new corporation. We couldn't merge with each other. We wouldn't merge with each other. We needed a corporate structure to develop the hospital in Maple Grove. So we created a new company called the Maple Grove Hospital Corporation. North Memorial owns 75% of it, and Fairview owns 25% of it. It will be part of North Memorial. It will be consolidated on our financial statements. It will be a vital asset to North Memorial's financial strength. And I'm not quite sure about the concerns on cross-subsidization, but we do, as part of the partnership provisions, we do have criteria that provide for distributions of capital between the two partners. But we are the 75% owner. It is part of North Memorial. And the concern regarding the transfer of FTEs, can you imagine the difficulty we would have trying to decide which employees could transfer now that it's a new corporation with two owners? Are they North Memorial employees that could transfer, or are they Fairview employees that could transfer? And what about all the other employees that provide health services in that community? We thought the best way to move forward was to set up a new corporation, and that's what we've done. There's a couple other things. One, if I may, the financial strength or the risk to North Memorial, it's very different now that the exception has been granted, because in the Maple Grove service area, North Memorial provided care to 34% of the patients from that service area. The hospital with the next highest market share had a market share of 12%. So if there is a hospital placed in Maple Grove, it will take business away from North Memorial. That was the financial concern. That was the key, the reason it was so important for us to succeed with this was that we could have the business move away from our organization totally if another hospital system succeeded. That's the concern from a financial perspective. That concern is no longer as significant as it was because of getting the exception approved. Regarding layoffs, during 2006, every hospital system in this community laid off employees because patient volumes were down. We'd like to know why the patient volumes are down. We're all studying it. We think there's some reasons that can be attributed to it. But everybody went through a layoff, and I can tell you now that in looking at the level of FTEs at North Memorial, they are just slightly lower than they were at the beginning of 2006. And particularly as it relates to the SEIU union, they are within one FTE of where we started 2006. So, and I think that's true in the other organizations. I think business has come back, particularly in the December-January timeframe, and positions have been replaced. I know there were several other comments that were made that I would like to respond to. I don't think I got them all down. Regarding the Level 1 Trauma Center, the Level 1 Trauma Center is at Robbinsdale. That is accredited by the American College of Surgeons. That cannot transfer. That is at Robbinsdale. That will stay at Robbinsdale. Regarding community benefit our commitment to charity care, we have a policy that we have adopted in Robbinsdale. We have adopted the same policy for Maple Grove. We have submitted for our tax exemption from the federal government for for Maple Grove, and that's included in that filing. And we've also agreed to the Attorney General letter regarding certain collection practices and discounts for the uninsured for both organizations. So that was, I tried to identify the concerns that were raised that I could respond to. I'd be happy to respond to any other questions, but I do want to comment on the impact on financing also.
Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll just take one break here. Senator Berglund, Senator Torres-Ray, and then Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, my question would be, is it not true that North Memorial closed their pediatric unit?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Buran.
Senator Berglund, yes, we consolidated it with a different unit because the census on that unit had dropped from basically 10 or 12 patients a day down to 2 patients a day. It is very difficult to run a unit with 2 patients. You have more staff on the unit than you do patients. We have since relocated those patients to reestablish a combined unit on a different floor. But the fact of the matter was, yes, we did close that unit.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the witness, actually two questions. So there is a decline in the number of patients. Could you expand on that, or could you tell us what are the numbers?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator, the decline we experienced in 2006 was about a 2% decline in admissions, and we believe that that's slightly greater decline than most of the other hospitals in town. We'd like to know why that decline occurred also. We think it has something to do with new benefit plans for insurance companies, and that's about as far as we go in terms of understanding the decline. The decline is citywide, and we did our best to respond to that, and regardless of the Maple Grove Hospital situation, we would have gone through the same process.
Thank you. And I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Senator,
I think I understand your presentation and the reason for seeking efficiency, but I want to make sure that I understood this. You said that you had to set a new corporation and that in this process transferring the FTEs is not possible, so you basically have to get rid of these employees because it's more convenient, more profitable. Could you explain that? So in terms of efficiency, you're moving into creating this corporation so you don't have to deal with your employees? I misunderstood your statement.
Madam Chair and Senator, we created the corporation because that was the only way that two existing corporations, North Memorial and Fairview, could partner to create the Maple Grove Hospital. We need a separate corporation to issue the bonds to finance the project, and so practically to create the hospital, we need a new organization, and that's why we formed it. The issue with regard to transferring FTEs is, number one, it's not a common transaction to transfer FTEs between two different corporations, and number two, as we looked at it, how would you decide which FTEs could transfer and which couldn't? We have North Memorial employees that live in that community. We have Fairview employees in that community. We have employees from TRICARE, all the TRICARE hospitals. And what we decided to do was to set up a new corporation and give people the opportunity to seek employment at that corporation. The impact on the Robbinsdale campus is to be determined. We're currently going through we're working on the financing. We're currently going through the process of evaluating the Robbinsdale campus. And certainly within 5 years, we're going to have more employees at the Robbinsdale campus than we do today. That is our belief.
Madam Chair, and to the witness, so does that mean that when you create this new corporation, really you could employ almost anyone because there is a new entity, and it's at your discretion to rehire the same people, or you could entirely change your staff?
Mr. Buran.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe the answer to your question is yes. Clearly, to the extent that individuals have worked at North or Fairview, they understand our processes, and I believe our representative from Fairview can discuss how they make decisions with regard to hiring employees for a multi-hospital system. Frankly, we haven't gotten to the point of deciding how we're going to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have Senator Hamm, then Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to clarify some of the testimony, because it is in conflict with earlier testimony that we heard about on two points, I think. One is that in the course of the discussion of forming the legislation that permitted this to go forward, that there was no contemplation that some other entity, some other corporate structure would be governing this other hospital. But it seems to me to be clear that when you have two, I know originally the bill was looking at trying to pick one entity to manage this new hospital. That turned out not to happen. So then there was an agreement to take two separate corporate entities and have them operate some hospital together. And in order to accomplish that, I don't know how you could do that without establishing some other independent entity that would be independent of either of the two existing corporate structures. So I just want to clarify that if it wasn't specified in the law and not forbidden by the law, I don't know how else you would allow two separate corporations to work together to operate a third hospital, unless they form some corporate structure to do that. And so whether it was discussed or agreed upon or someone didn't anticipate it, I don't know how else you could do it. So just to make that clear. The second thing is that there was testimony that said that this was some completely separate company, which I guess is technically true because it is a separate legal entity. But clearly the ownership structure is related to the two existing corporations. And as the witness said, that 75% is owned by North Memorial. So that to say that this entity is completely independent, completely separate, and has nothing to do with the others, I don't think is quite the case. And so I want to make sure that I heard that correctly from the witness, that in my mind, what we have is a structure that had to be put in place once the bill was passed to accomplish the goals of the bill, and that the entity that was formed is not some completely separate outside of the scope of the original legislation. And would you just make sure I've got that correctly? Did I hear that correctly from your testimony?
Mr. Buran.
Senator, you're correct.
Senator Berglund. Senator, could you use the microphone, please?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think, however, that it was very clear that the role that Fairview would play in the new hospital would be a secondary role. They were not going to have 50 or even 50% control of the operation, and that they were going to be limited to certain types of services that would be provided at the new facility. And that is the testimony that we heard. And one of the reasons that I can remember that very vividly is because one of the things that I had hoped we would accomplish in the legislation was to guarantee a minimum number of mental health beds. That is a concern all over about the need for mental health beds. And when we build a new hospital, it seemed to me reasonable to ask them to have beds to serve the mental health needs of people in their own community. We couldn't get a guarantee of any number of beds, just that there would be at least a bed. And it was very clear during the conference committee that if it had been up to Fairview, they would have done that. But they were not in a position to make that kind of a guarantee because they were not going to be in a position to be able to fulfill any kind of commitment in that regard, in that they were limited to the outpatient portion of the mental health services at the new hospital.
We still have four people lined up to testify, so I'm going to go to Senator Worgen's question, and then we'll move on to additional witnesses.
Madam Chair, did you say question?
A question, comment, questions? Senator Worgen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I'm going to start just where you left off, even though I've got some questions from back further. When you're talking about who was going to operate what portions of the hospital and how that was going to be spelled out, was that in a different committee than here? I think I was here for most of the hearings in this room, but I don't remember hearing that Fairview was going to be a certain percentage and do certain cares, and North was going to do others.
Madam Chair and Senator Worgen, that's because when it was in this committee, there never was a partnership being discussed. That partnership arose after the bill went to conference committee. And so that discussion took place in the conference committee.
Madam Chair, that explains part of the other things that I was going to, too, because that is exactly what I recall, that in this committee it was various hospitals testifying, which is And actually, I think we got a better proposal by having the combination of Fairview and North Memorial. I think we have something better than we would have had with one or the other. And so that's part of what brings me back to some of the other testimony, too. I understand that the North employees, and believe me, I have a lot of North employees and a lot of Fairview employees in my district, so I probably got more letters than Senator Lemmer did, except mine were probably a little bit more diverse than his. And so I remember that, and I actually, obviously the employees would advocate for their own hospital to be the hospital that got the new location and built there, whether it be North or Fairview. But it didn't work that way, and we have, I think, a better situation because we have two well-thought-of hospitals with good reputations, two entities that have merged to do something that I think is going to be excellent for the Maple Grove area. So then you get into the transfer of employees that we were talking about earlier, and I really can't help but think for the employees in both institutions, whether it's Fairview or North, it would be pretty hard to set up a protocol of we're going to take 60 employees from North and we're going to take 40 employees from Fairview and give them preferential treatment. But in any institution, in any hospital or any entity like that, I can't help but think that well-qualified employees with a good work service record would walk into this new facility and automatically, by looking back at their record, whether it was at Fairview or North, be given some preferential treatment for being hired. After all, how they've worked and how well they worked and how good they are, and they are good employees at both places. I know that. I have never relatives at both. and so I think they will be given the preferential treatment that they're afraid they won't get. But it's pretty hard when you have two entities that have totally separate union contracts with their nurses, their SEIU employees, et cetera, et cetera. The contracts are very different. How would you possibly go to a completely separate corporation and give basically the same employee status? There has to be something over time that develops. And I do have to go back to the layoffs. And Senator Berglund, with all due respect, I don't think it had to do with the bonding. I'm not that financially savvy about bonding and stuff like that, but I do know that a lot of hospitals have laid off. I do know that two of the hospitals in my district have laid off, and it has nothing to do with bonding or anything like that. It's just the dynamics of what's gone on in that particular industry over the past year. But I still think that, with all due respect, the employees, if they've been great employees in the other two places, when they walk in and make an application at this place, they're probably very likely to be the first people hired.
I'm going to take your comments, Senator Wergen, as rhetorical questions and move on to hear the rest of the witnesses. We still have four to hear from, and then we'll continue conversation. Cheryl Strait.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Strait, and I'm the Director of Corporate Human Resources for Fairview Health Services. I have been a Fairview University employee for 33 years, and I've had 27 years' experience in managing human resource programs. I will be brief, but first off, I want to make sure you know that Fairview does value their employees. They are our greatest strength. And we always have a number of opportunities for growth within our organization, as well as programs to allow for educational advancement. We are an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer, and we are working very hard to hire employees that reflect the changing demographics in Minnesota. We expect no layoffs as a result of expanding our services in the Maple Grove area. When we do have layoffs, we do have priority placement process that we do abide by, so that layoff is our last alternative. We try to place people in open positions whenever possible. We believe that Maple Grove will represent opportunities for our employees in both the inpatient and the outpatient setting, and I'm sure there will be lots of employees who will look forward to making an application for these positions. But we do have concerns with this bill. First, we are concerned about prescribing specific hiring and employee compensation and benefit practices into statute. Due doing so is inconsistent with our philosophy on equal opportunity, and we do not support biases against or in favor of any group of employee. Lastly, we intend on keeping our commitment to you, the employees, and the Maple Grove community to provide high-quality inpatient and outpatient services, including mental health. We can do this by having a competitive and open hiring process so that our top talent for all roles can be recruited and hired for Maple Grove.
Thank you very much. Let's also hear from Kathy Knight.
Kathy is here to answer questions. I'd like, I'm Pat Cooksey from North Memorial.
Okay.
I'd like to defer to Kathy Haney to have her have the ability to talk about the effects of this legislation on potential bond.
Thank you, Ms. Cooksey. We'll hear from Kathy Hahn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Haney, and I'm a lawyer at Fagry & Benson, and we represent the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. I am not here to take a position on either side, obviously, of this issue for this particular hospital or the policy decisions that go along with it, but I am here to tell you a little bit about what our members have experienced in terms of this type of legislation and the impact it might have on financing. The Minnesota Institute of Public Finance is composed of financial advisors, bond lawyers, and the municipal kind of bond houses that that provide this kind of debt, Piper Jaffray, Doherty, Dane, NetRosher, et cetera. Our members have as clients cities, counties, townships, school districts, hospitals, those kinds of public entities. When debt is issued for a project such as a hospital, as discussed earlier, we do create a document called the offering statement. And as mentioned earlier, it is a thick document, and it does list out various risks that investors would encounter and need to consider when they are investing their money, when they are purchasing bonds for any kind of project. And our members... those investors are used to various risks, such as construction risk, weather risk, strike risk. I mean, there's a long list of the kinds of risks that any investor is familiar with and knows that they must assume. And sometimes in certain projects, there are unusual risks that the investor knows that they must assume. But again, those are risks that they are able to understand up front and evaluate in terms of their investment. When there is an ambiguity or an essential element like a license that must be disclosed, because of course it must be disclosed to potential investors, that is a type of risk that is outside of the scope of what is considered normal and is outside of the scope that our members have experienced is something that investors will easily assume. And thus, what my members are telling me that something like a key issue, like a license, or any sort of ambiguities like other factors, then make the project extremely difficult to finance. And things that happen after the fact, after they have reviewed a business plan, but that then is a new element of a business plan after construction, after they invested their money. Those are also risks that they are very uncomfortable with, because what a rated agency can do is downgrade the analysis of the creditworthiness of those particular bonds, and that also then affects the value of the investment they made. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's the information I have today.
Thank you, Ms. Haney, for the explanation about the bonding process. It seems after what you've explained and what you analyze in terms of their risk and stature that it would seem this corporation's got themselves into a bit of a bonding pickle.
Is that a rhetorical comment, or did you want me to comment on that?
No, that's all right. I'll leave it as a rhetorical question as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
While we have an expert on bonding, I'd like to ask a question myself. Ms. Hahn, you've seen the amendment, the delete everything amendment, and there seems to be a couple new provisions that are on page one, community benefits, community care, those are new criteria that I believe is trying to be added to the criteria list of this new hospital. Now, as you consider these new criteria lists, will those affect the bond rating that has already been, or in, it's being computed now based on existing law, what this legislature passed before? Adding these, will that affect the bond rating of the project in Maple Grove? Are these factors that are big enough to do so?
You know, Senator, I represent the organization and don't actually do the work myself. What I am told is that when there are ambiguities that would have a material impact on the business plan, which a rating agency has reviewed, they will absolutely take it into account. It's a pretty sophisticated computer analysis that is done when they provide a rating on these things. And what they really don't like are when they can't figure out whether it's a material impact and what the material impact is. So it's clearly something that will be disclosed and will be analyzed, and whether it will actually impact the rating is not something I can tell you.
Madam Chair,
thank you,
this is the problem. The new criteria has now begun to change the formula of how to account for bonding. This ambiguity is causing a whole new definition from a bonding or financing perspective on this. Once the legislature passes a bill, and going now 2 years in order to create it for a community, a much-needed critical health care asset like a hospital, I would think that promise made in the statute books for that community should be one that we live up to. Now we're coming up with new benefits or new criteria for the further licensing of this hospital, which affects the financing. If this passes, this could very, very, it has a likelihood that it could kill the entire hospital going into the Maple Grove area.
Thank
and I don't
you,
think
Senator
anyone
Limmer.
Wants that.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I think I probably should clarify for Senator Limmer and members of the committee. These first two parts of the bill, Subdivision 1A and Subdivision 1B, these would be general definitions that the Department of Health would use in the future just to measure community benefit in general for all hospitals. This was a recommendation in their report back to us that we come up with some standard definitions. They created one for the purpose of doing the report, but they thought for the future to continue monitoring it that there should be some definition that the legislature would adopt. So that's kind of a separate issue. Then the language that's in Section 3 is the language that would affect the Maple Grove facility. And all it's doing is asking the Department of Health to look at some things beyond what is in the current law regarding the applicant's current level of community benefit, whether they'll be able to maintain it, the impact on the workforce center at the existing facility, and a commitment of the applicant to provide existing workforce the right for first refusal of jobs. So I just want to be clear, because I think Senator Limmer was kind of confusing the two parts of the bill.
Senator Berglund, is Subdivision 3 that you're talking about, the process for determining community benefit, is this a standard process?
This is the part of the law that was adopted last year in regard to the Department of Health's review of public interest in granting a new hospital license.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, could I clarify something?
Yes. Please state your name again.
I'm Pat Cooksey from North Memorial.
Thank you.
The concern that's being raised here is that the pending legislation that's being proposed in this committee does create risk for our bond rating, not the legislation that was approved in the 2006 session. The fact that there will be yet another review, and the license is dependent on that, which is also different than any other exception that's gone on and been passed in the legislation in the last 20 years, causes that risk. And with that risk in the bond market increases the price and even increases the potential that we would not be able to get bonds for the project. I just wanted to clarify that. It's Section 3 specifically in this current legislation that Senator Berglund is proposing.
And Ms. Cooksey, would you say that the section that we're talking about then is something that the hospital or corporation was not in compliance with before?
No. No, what they're asking, we have been following, excuse me, Madam Chairman, I'm Pat Cooksey. We have been following the legislation that was passed last year in the 2006 session. We filed a joint report of the new corporation to the Department of Health to comply of how we would comply with all of the criteria that was in the 2006 legislation. They have reviewed that, and then there is a subsequent process that the Department of Health, which is, I think, you have a letter from the Department of Health indicating how they review hospitals for licensure, that actually would be the same way they've done that for any other hospital, which is what is important for future bond investors, is that there's no change in that normal process.
Thank you. We do have one other person on the list, David Feinwax. Is he here? Mr. Feinwax, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Dave Feinwax. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I'd like to say at the outset that we express our thanks to Senator Berglund and the proponents of this legislation for engaging us in discussion and working on this issue of mutual importance. I'd like to make a comment and express a concern. First, Minnesota hospitals are committed to transparency in terms of community benefit. We have recently voluntarily reported our community benefit statistics to the Department of Health, who has done a study for the very first time assessing our activities in this area compared to the benefit we receive of nonprofit status. I'm proud to say that report was very favorable. Obviously, given a choice between a voluntary system and a mandate in a piece of legislation, we'd prefer voluntary. Having said that, we're going to study the proposed mandate because we use the standards of the Catholic Hospital Association, and we don't want to have to report two different ways, but we're perfectly willing to provide this information to the public. We are, however, very, very concerned about the ambiguity that this proposal creates, not just for North and Fairview in this situation, but for all of Minnesota hospitals going forward. The concept that we will change the moratorium exception process in this state to one where an entity will be told, build a facility, invest $100 million, $150 million, and after that investment is made, we will decide whether you can have a license to operate it, will make financing virtually impossible. You need only ask yourself, would you invest in something like that, where there's a complete second guess. All of Minnesota hospitals will be affected going forward. It is a very serious matter for hospital financing in this state, and we are very, very concerned about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwax. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, and also just to clarify, the bill we have before us, the amendment we have before us, would be prospective. So what we're trying to do here is to avoid any time there would be another hospital that would come forward asking to have a moratorium exception from ignoring these issues that are being raised in this particular situation. The intent of the amendment is not to go back and retroactively amend the moratorium law that we already have in place that was used for the siting of the new facility in Maple Grove. Simply to say these are problems. We didn't see what they were at the time we did it last time. Let's amend the law so in the future, if we have another moratorium exception that comes forward, these things would be considered.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Wergen, very quickly, and then we've spent about an hour on this subject. I think we're ready to vote.
Well, Madam Chair, it's a very important subject. Senator Berglund, I'm glad you just said that because that's what I've been kind of bopping around the room to find out, is if this would apply to the current moratorium, and you're saying it does not. However, does the licensure part, in other words, does that apply to this facility? So kind of like who'd build a building if they didn't think they could occupy it at the end. So in other words, does the discretion for the licensure apply to this hospital or to future moratorium exceptions?
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, in this bill, the criteria would apply to the license. But having said that, let me also just say, since I am the author of the bill, what I said to my folks that asked me to carry the bill, all the bill says is that the commissioner has to look at it. It doesn't say a license may or may not be issued based on this. You know, it says that the commissioner should look at it before granting a license. So I don't think it's going to probably change too much, except that we've got people at the table. Maybe they'll talk more to each other and see if they can get this thing worked out that they've got going on currently.
Well, I think we're ready to call the vote.
Madam Chair.
People probably have, if very quickly, Mr. or yeah. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know. That's what I
apparently, there's a lot of concern on the part of two particular corporations that feel that this is some type of threat to the ongoing project in Maple Grove. Pat Cooksey is here representing North Memorial, who has a little bit of a concern, and I think the committee needs to hear why they're here. If, in fact, this is geared for a prospective venue, why are they concerned? And I'm not sure if that has been specifically aired, and I'd like to give Pat Cooksey
an
immediate concern of why North Memorial is concerned about this.
Before we get too, thank you, Madam Chair. Before we get too far afield, though, addressing what Senator Berglund said about all the commissioner has to do is look at it, maybe if this is perspective, we can push out the date of when it takes effect that the commissioner reviews. Push out the date for a few years of effectiveness, and then you don't have the concern on this hospital.
Madam Chair, and Senator Johnson, that would not be my wish to have that done with the bill. Madam Chair, I also would just like to have the folks that are supporting the bill refute a few of the statements that were made earlier about the hiring practices of the new corporation.
Madam.
Actually, I think the committee is, is not ready to vote. This is a very complex issue, and I think that we could probably go on till midnight, but I will call on Senator Wergen, and then we are going to have Senator Berglund move her bill.
Madam Chair, on 3.1, because that's what I've been trying to establish, it does say the commissioner may refuse to grant the license for the project, okay? So it does say the commissioner may refuse. So, Madam Chair, in the interest of moving this bill and making it work, after hearing Senator Berglund say that the commissioner would look at the criteria, I'm going to move to amend the bill to take out lines 2.33 through 2.35, which is just G of that section that says the commissioner may refuse. Because if the object is just to look at, that isn't what this says.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Wergen, the bill does say that the commissioner may refuse to grant a license. Does anybody think that the commissioner is going to? I mean, I don't think she's going to. I do think that asking these organizations to look a little more closely at what we have indicated in the bill is a concern would be a wise thing for them to do before they apply for the license.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that's why I'm not taking anything out, just that section, just that G where it says the commissioner may refuse.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Wergen, I would oppose that amendment.
Thank you. Senator Wergen, would you like to move your amendment?
I would, Madam Chair.
Further discussion on Senator Wergen's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion fails. Senator Berglund, would you like to make an motion on your bill?
I would move that Senate File 967 as amended be recommended to pass.
Is there further discussion on Senator Berglund's motion?
Where is it
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd like to take up Senate File 1398. And Madam Chair, Senate File 1398 is a fairly simple, but I think very important fairness concept, and that is that an individual can designate a domestic partner who has a right to visit them when they are in the hospital, when they are sick, when they are dying. I think this is basic human right for people to be around their loved ones, and especially at the time when they're receiving medical care, when they may be at risk of dying or when they are in the process of dying. I think this is a critically important issue, and this bill would simply make it something you don't have to fight for that right to do. Right now, you could go to court to give somebody rights to visit
you.
I don't think that's the way we want to do it. We've had people situations where two partners will have to explain to their child why only one can go visit. I don't think we want to get into where we deny people the right to visit their loved ones in the hospital. And with that, I have Ann DeGroot here and Stevie Dallas to speak to the bill as well.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Ann DeGroot. I'm the Executive Director of Outfront Minnesota, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk in favor of Senate File 1398, which, as Senator Marty just explained, would allow domestic partners, regardless of their sexual orientation, to visit each other in the hospital. There are really a couple of reasons I think that this bill is important. The first is, of course, that it is an issue that affects the GLBT community regularly. In my work at Outfront Minnesota, we hear all kinds of stories from people all over the state every year about things that happen to them that are different than they see in their neighbors, coworkers, and family members because they are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. Some of the most heart-wrenching stories are the stories we hear when people tell us about not being able to visit or be with a partner when they are ill, when they've come into the emergency room, or in some cases when they are dying. Today you're going to hear testimony from people who will address that for you, I think, well, better than I can. But one of the points I wish to make about that is this. One of the issues that we see is this is inconsistent throughout the state. If you live in the Twin Cities, usually most of the hospitals will allow domestic partners to be with each other. There's not a lot of questions asked. But there are other places in the state where this isn't true. And so for someone who lives in another part of the state to have to fear that they're not going to be able to see their partner in the hospital is a very real situation that we don't often see here. I've been in a position over the past year to be using our hospital systems in the Twin Cities with my partner, and we've experienced a great deal of graciousness and kindness on the part of hospital staff, doctors. But I do know from my colleagues, from my friends out in greater Minnesota, that often this isn't true, and it's also true in some places in the Twin Cities. The second issue here that I think is equally as important is that this bill would clarify for hospital staff and hospitals about what the statutes are. There are real concerns on the part of people out there serving the public who have the best interests at heart that if they allow domestic partners to visit each other in the hospital, and frankly, this bill addresses all domestic partners, regardless of sexual orientation, but the people we hear from, obviously, are people who are in same-sex relationships, that they're afraid that if they allow that to happen, the hospital may be sued, they might lose their job. In many cases, these are people for whom there aren't other jobs in their community necessarily. So this will help really, I think, clarify for those well-meaning, good people out there about what the limits are of their authority in this regard. And to that, I'd like to say that the Minnesota Nurses Association has endorsed this bill, in part because they have expressed concern about that, and we have heard from many nurses and other healthcare professionals about this. So I appreciate being able to be here today to speak with you. I will be around if you have questions that you would like to ask, but I really think the people to hear from here are those who have directly experienced this. And so thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Hallisey, and I'm from Rochester.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for letting me speak today. The incident I'm going to talk about happened in April of 1993, but it is just as relevant today as these incidents continue to happen. On this particular day, my partner Vicki had a surgical biopsy of a lymph node in her neck. She was, of course, scared and nervous. So was I. I am a healthcare professional. I work in cancer care. And so my mind was working overtime as to what the possibility of this diagnosis could be. By noon that day, we realized our worst fears as our doctor told us that indeed Vicki had cancer. I am sure most everyone here has someone close to them, a coworker, a family friend, or maybe yourself, who have heard the news that cancer has entered your life. It is a devastating thing to hear. It's devastating physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. As a radiation therapist, I see it every day. And that day, it got personal. That evening, as we sat at home trying to come to grips with this cancer diagnosis, Vicki developed a surgical complication. The lymph node cautery in her neck had failed, and her neck began to swell drastically as the lymph drained into the surrounding tissues. She was having trouble breathing, and the side of her neck looked like there was a large grapefruit stuffed under the skin. We made a hurried trip to the ER. Once there, the nurses looked at her and wanted to take her right back to the ER, and I was at Vic's side holding her hand, and we came up to the double doors that separate the lobby from the actual ER area when a nurse asked me if I was family. And though we share the same last name, I could have lied and said I was her sister or cousin or something. But I just don't want to be able to, I don't want to have to deny that relationship that we have. So I looked at the nurse and I said, well, not family per se, we're partners and I want to be with her. And the nurse held up her hand in front of me and said, well, in that case, will you please have a seat in the lobby? We'll take care of things from here. And Vicki was, you know, taken through those double doors. She was crying. She was reaching out for me. And she was going back there alone. It was a horrible thing to have to endure that day. And I don't think anyone would want to be in that position of having to face cancer and its effects alone. I have to say, though, that we had a happy ending in that the physician who did her surgery that day was also the physician on call that night, and he told the nurse to go back out in the lobby and get me. So the physician was very sensitive to our needs, but the ER nurse and some of the other people in the ER were not so. This shouldn't have to happen to anyone. I think the patient should have the right to define family. And there was no excuse for my partner that day to face cancer alone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
My name is Gerald Waters, and I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for inviting me to testify on this important bill. Early in 1980, I became involved with the AIDS epidemic, providing support for HIV/AIDS patients and their parents, partners, and families. I soon found out that the life partner had little visitation rights or input into the care of the patient. Many times, a patient had not had contact with the family for years, and as a result, the patient's wishes were not carried out. The only way a life partner I could give care, I or I as a caregiver could get involved was to have a document, power of attorney and health care directive. Securing these documents are expensive. After having my first heart attack and struggling with this issue, my life partner and I discussed the patient visitation situation, and we decided to get the proper documents. We now have and carry with us at all times the power of attorney and the health care directives. We now have this also, and this cost us $1,000 to secure these documents. We now have these on file with the Mayo Clinic, but it's only for Rochester. So when we travel, we carry these documents with us at all times. Well, we both have siblings. Who knows better what our health care wishes are than the person that you've chosen as a life partner? I urge you to support this bill to allow people that can't afford the cost of caring for one another. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. My name is Lindsay Flint, and I live in St. Paul with my partner, Terry. But my story is not about access to my partner, but about access to our son. My partner, Terry, and I have been together for 17 years, and we have two boys, Tori, age 9, and Joe, age 6. 4 years ago, we were visiting Terry's parents in International Falls, and this was over the Thanksgiving weekend. And our son Joe had a cold, but he was running around with his normal exuberance until Saturday evening. He became very lethargic and started wheezing. We quickly determined that he needed to go to the emergency room. And my partner Terry grew up in International Falls, and as you may know, it's a one-hospital town. And the next closest hospital actually is in an even smaller town in Cook. So the emergency room in International Falls was our choice. We arrived at the emergency room at about 10:30 p.m., and Joe was wheezing and crying and obviously in distress. But because I'm a self-employed attorney, and Terry's a Ramsey County child protection worker, she carries the boys on her insurance, so she went to the desk to take care of that paperwork while I carried Joe back to the examining room. The one doctor who was on duty in the hospital that night listened to Joe's lungs and immediately ordered an oxygen mask and IV for him. Joe was writhing and screaming while I tried to hold him and calm him down for these procedures. A little note about our son, Joe. We adopted him from Hennepin County Foster Care when he was 2 months old. And he's a beautiful little boy. And we were told they believe he's half Guatemalan. So needless to say, he doesn't look like either of his Minnesota-born mothers. He also, has some sensory integration issues, and he had night terrors, so this emergency room visit was very, very distressing to him. And in the midst of this chaos, Terry came back into the room, and the doctor looked at her and said she'd have to leave. Well, trying to hold Joe still for an IV and over his crying and screaming, I said, "She's his mother." And then he said, "Then who are you?" And I said, "I am his mother." And he said, "How can you both be his mother?" This continued for several more seconds, seemed like minutes or hours to me, actually. And all the time this conversation is going on, Joe is screaming and fighting for oxygen. I'm scared because I know that he's very ill and not able to breathe. And the last thing I wanted to be doing was explaining how and why my son had two mothers. And the last thing I wanted to be doing was justifying why we both had the right to be there with him in this room. And the last thing I needed to be proving was our relationship to our son. I yelled at this point, "He has two moms, okay?" And the room became silent for a minute. And Then, thankfully, a nurse who had gone to school with my partner was on duty that night, and she recognized her and greeted her. And we don't know if it was my hysterics or this recognition, but my partner, Terry, was allowed to stay and help hold Joe, and he got an IV, and we took him down to X-ray. And it was determined that he had pneumonia, and he was admitted into the hospital. The happy ending to our story also is that, I can't tell you how inclusive and accommodating the nurses and the staff at the hospital was over the next 3 days. They set up cots for both of us to stay in his room. They brought us meals. We commiserated with nurses about how frightening it is to have children who are in the emergency room or have serious illnesses. We brainstormed about videos and ways to distract him from all of the tubes and the needles. And we ended up actually donating videos to the hospital and sending them a thank you note. And I think that most people, staff of the hospitals, want to acknowledge our families if they're given the opportunity. And we're lucky because Terry and I both have a legal relationship to our children. But despite this legal relationship, we still have to take extra steps to make sure that we always have access to them at school, in medical emergencies. So we learned several things from this crisis. One is that we always carry the boys' birth certificates with us, always. And I'm an attorney, and many of my clients are same-sex parents, and I advise them to do the same for their children wherever they go. And if they're not legal parents, to carry a delegation of parental authority form. But domestic partners don't have a certificate to display to anyone. So I advised them to carry their partner's health care directive in their car. But not everyone has done that. And even if you have done it, as we have, we don't always remember to carry it with us everywhere we go. So I believe that these revisions to Section 144 will help ensure that domestic partners will be able to be with their loved ones in the most vulnerable and frightening time in their lives. And I respectfully ask that you vote for this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Marty, do you have somebody else? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Laurie Flacker, and this situation that I experienced took place when my partner was in 2004 on February 27th, was cooking dinner and talking on the phone and just collapsed. And the phone, broke into many pieces, and I put it back together and called 911. And not knowing what was going on or what was wrong with her, was on the phone with 911 telling them, what she was experiencing. And finally, after a few different phone calls, the ambulance arrived, and, they talked to me about the different medicines she was on. By now she was semi-conscious. And, I got the medicines and was helping them, and they, decided which hospital to take her to. I'm not from here, so I didn't really even know where the closest hospital was or the one that carried her insurance. So finally, they prepared to take her to the hospital, and I said, okay, well, I'll get ready to go. And they said, oh, no, you're not going with us. And I said, but I have to go because she's unconscious, and I need to go with her and help. And they said, no, we're not taking you with us. And they wouldn't let me go with her because they said I was upset. And I find that anyone that would expect somebody not to be upset when their partner collapses and is, thrashing around on the kitchen floor and then not, unconscious, I think it would be a common thing to expect someone to be nervous. But they wouldn't take me, no one in my neighborhood was home at that time, and I ended up calling her brother out in Eden Prairie. We lived down in South Minneapolis. And as they were driving away with her, I was hysterical on the front step because she really needed me. At the time when she really needed me most, I couldn't be there for her. She couldn't make any decisions. She was incapacitated. And I couldn't help her because someone else made the decision that I shouldn't go with her. So finally, her brother arrived from Eden Prairie, and we went to the hospital. And luckily, in the hospital, I had the support and helped to make those decisions. But it took us quite a while to get there because I waited for him. And when we got there, the neurologist said that we should, agree to have her put into a coma because she had an aneurysm, and that would be a way to stop the aneurysm, that blood flow that was killing her. And, we agreed. I helped make that decision with her brother, and, I was treated with respect in the hospital, and part of the decisions, and I believe that the time that it took to make those decisions for us to get to the hospital, I don't think it would have made a difference in her condition. It still would have ended the same, I believe. So over that evening, people came and people went, and we talked to different neurologists during the evening. And the next day, it was determined that we would really have to take her off life support. So the rest of her family, she had six brothers and sisters, all came in from different parts of the country. And we made that decision that, collectively to take her off life support, because it wouldn't have been a way that she would want to live. And I was happy that I was able to make that decision and help with that decision, but I was very unhappy that the last part of her life was stolen from me because of someone's decision that I shouldn't go because I wasn't her husband or I wasn't his wife. And why should that have been something that was taken away from me? And why? I think that it wouldn't have made a difference because it would have ended the same, but I never really know that. Had I been able to be there earlier and make those decisions, that situation may have turned out differently. I don't think so, but there's a possibility. And for myself, my story remains the same, but for other people, people are experiencing this all the time and living with that they weren't there for their partner when their partner needed them most. So I know, had it have been the other way around, she would have done anything to get in the ambulance. So my story ended as it ended, but I think for other people, we need to band together and we need to support everyone under the same laws.
Thank you very
Madam
much,
Chair.
Ms. Flacker. Senator Cornyn had a question, and Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to make a statement and just say thank you for the people that came here to testify. It was really, really powerful testimony that I think I can't speak on behalf of the other members, but it was certainly great testimony that we need to hear. We need to hear these powerful stories so that we can make the decisions that affect everybody's life. And I want to thank Senator Marty publicly and Senator Berglund for being on this bill. This is an important bill, and I can't see anybody that would ever be opposed to something like this. I can't see it. Obviously, if anybody's opposed to this, I guess I couldn't understand how anybody could be opposed to this. So,
thank you, Senator Cornyn. Senator Dole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also support this bill. I did have one question, though, and I don't know who could answer it, maybe Senator Marty. In your testimony about not being able to go on the ambulance, does this legislation correct that, or is that still going to be an issue? Because I see once you're admitted to a facility, then you have the rights, but I don't see anything about beforehand. I don't know if that situation would be corrected by this legislation.
Madam Chair. I'd like to speak to Senator Dahl and to the testifier. Ma'am, I'd like to offer you comfort in that going on three years ago now, my husband was involved in a really serious motorcycle accident. He was transported to a level one. I was able to make the decision where, but they wouldn't allow me in the ambulance. So just to offer you some comfort on that, I don't know that was a whatever kind of decision on the ambulance driver's part. I wasn't allowed in the ambulance either because probably the severity or the service itself may have had a policy, but I wasn't allowed in either. But my question on the and that might answer your question too. I think that there's some vagueness out there. Maybe the service, probably not a policy decision. But my question on the legislation, Senator Marty, is the words domestic partner going to make a difference? Because what identifies a domestic partner, and you know, could the word be a designated person? Because I don't know that the way it's written is going to make an actual difference.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, first of all, I'm not sure if Senator Dahl raises a very good point, and I want to make sure it does cover that, and I'm not sure it does. To Senator Johnson's question, I think in this case, the definition of domestic partner, it's one who shares a residence and who produces documentation of a legal responsibility. So in effect, it's not the way we think of domestic partner as a life partner, generally a same-sex partner. I think it could be somebody other than that if they chose to. The point is it's when you're in the hospital, you want your designee, your family, to be able to have access to you. And so the way it's defined here, you could define another adult as a member of your family as your domestic partner. But to me, the point is that the person, you know who your family is, you know who loves you, who cares about you, you know who you want to have with you. And I think this will address that concern. But I think Senator Dahl's question is a very important one that I'd like to see if there's a way we can address that.
Senator Marty, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, it sounds like there's still paperwork involved with designating the partner, and that would still take legal advice. It seems that they have that option right now. And why are we legislating domestic partner in law, word language-wise?
Senator Marty. Mr. Cooper, could you please introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, my name is Scott Cooper. I work at Outfront Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, there could potentially be paperwork. This bill, as written, allows several different avenues. One of them is for the patient to designate if they are conscious and able to do so, to designate the person as their domestic partner, which they could simply do by telling the people at intake, this is my partner. It also allows the family to designate a person as the domestic partner. It also allows a hospital visitation by a person who's been appointed the health care agent under a statute that already exists, 145C, which allows you to give someone hospital medical decision-making power. In drafting this, we didn't intend to go there, but we found out from the revisor's office that if you've designated somebody as your healthcare agent, that doesn't necessarily allow them to visit you in the hospital, which seemed odd, so we're trying to fix that here also. So there are a few different paths. The one that we would hope you wouldn't get to, but that we do allow for here, is where the patient is unable to designate the person as the partner. There's no other family present to designate who the partner is, and where the domestic partner would say on their own, I am that person's partner, which we would hope would be sufficient, just as it would normally be sufficient to say, I am that person's spouse, I am that person's sister or daughter, and they would not ask for proof of that. But we do, under the definition of domestic partner here, then allow some ways that if they were questioning whether you were their domestic partner, you could show that through proving joint residence, joint checking account, that sort of thing.
Senator Johnson, and I just want to remind the committee, we have one more bill to go. There are other people who wish to testify, and we need to move. So, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And being sensitive to the first testifier speaking to not wanting to lie and say she's my sister, I have been in the situation many times where I have outright lied to get into to see an important person. Again, I'm not sure that the legal statutory wording needs to be in statute because, you know, I understand she didn't want to lie. I'm trying to be sensitive to that. But I've had people walk into my family members' hospital rooms, and I'll say, how'd you get in there? And they'll say, well, I just said I was so-and-so. So.
Thank you. Senator Marty, there are other people
Chair,
who wish to testify.
I think we're done with our witnesses, but okay. In response to Senator Johnson, I think it is important point is, yeah, we hope in most cases you don't have to do anything more than say, I'm their partner. But if it becomes a controversy, you don't want to have anybody be able to deny your family from being with you, and this would make sure they have the legal protection they need if they need it. Again, the hope is that they don't need it, that you can just say, I'm the partner, and that's acceptable.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I think Mr. Tom Pritchard is here, and he wishes to testify against this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, and I want to testify, I guess, in support of part of the bill and in opposition to other parts. First of all, we have no problem in allowing individuals, patients, residents, adults to decide who should have visitation and health care decision-making power. We think that's entirely appropriate for adults to be able to make that power, so we don't see any problems with that. The concerns we have with the bill or would object to is the creating of a family redefinition or creating an entirely new status of domestic partnership. We see problems with that for a couple reasons. One is it's unnecessary. I think just giving an individual, clearly giving an individual the power to make visitation decisions on who can visit them and health care decision-making powers will cover that. But also we see those in relationships, domestic partners, inherently discriminatory and unfair to other people. They give special status to certain individuals and exclude other individuals, and we think that's just a bad public policy. And we have a concern that if the state begins writing in alternative statuses, marriage-like statuses, it'll make our marriage law more vulnerable in court. A number of three Supreme Courts recently have used the existence of domestic partner and other arrangements as part of the basis for their overturning their state's marriage laws or mandating the creation of civil unions, which are identical to marriage except by name. So we see this as laying the legal foundation to potential attacks on our marriage laws. So that's our position. We support part of it, but we also object to part of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Are there any questions, Senator Hamm?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of questions. One is, and maybe Senator Marty knows, or maybe counsel knows, but do we have any other provision of law definition of domestic partner currently in statute?
Senator Marty.
Senate I'm not counsel. Sure if we do, and maybe Senate counsel does know.
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I guess part of my concern and with the language of this and not the intent, because I certainly support the intent, but I'm sure that you're well aware, as we all are, that the term domestic partner has meaning to it that maybe goes beyond the direct intent of the bill. And I think there may be some concern that if we're trying to allow for people who care for or who love other people to be able to make decisions on their behalf when there's not a formal relationship in place, that we should find a way to accommodate that. But by creating a definition and specifying its meaning in this place, I think, to me, seems unnecessary to accomplish that goal. One of the things I wanted to ask just out of, you know, just maybe more technically, but on page 2 of the bill, lines 217 to 2.19, that last sentence of paragraph D, why wouldn't that or a shortened version of that sentence suffice for the whole paragraph? That sentence says a domestic partner, and I would suggest using a different designation, a designated individual or something of that, something a little bit more neutral perhaps, may be identified as such by the patient or the patient's family, and leave it at that, because if we're saying these other criteria that are listed before can be superseded by just designating a person to be that, why would we need to have all the prior definition? And so I guess I would like to perhaps see us contemplate amending this to say let's change the designation of that relationship to something a little more neutral and maybe make it a little more simple and just say that someone can be designated to serve in that capacity, and when they're in that capacity, they can make those decisions and have those privileges. Would you be amenable to that, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, the trouble if you just have it where it can be identified by the patient or the patient's family is when the patient is comatose or unable to speak for themselves, and is in one of these situations we heard from was clearly the case. The point here is we want to make sure that somebody's family, their partner, has the chance to be with them at all times with as little hassle as possible. I think saying that somebody there from the patient or patient's family who says this is the partner, they're part of the family too, that should be sufficient. And if that isn't sufficient because there's nobody there to say that, then they should be able to have as many options. I'd like to have as many ways as possible so there is no extra legal requirements for some people to say, this is the person I love, this is the person I want to have with me. The whole point is to make it as simple as possible, as many options as possible, because to me, what's a family? It's people you live with. It's people who you love. It's people you care about. Everybody's definition of family is different in their case. But I think we understand family are the people you live with, the people you love, people who care about you. They're the ones you want to have around you. And I think the important thing is we make it as simple as possible for people to have access to their loved ones, especially at medical emergency times.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, Mr. Pritchard already went back and away from the table. I had a series of questions, and I know we're in a hurry, so I guess I'll skip that series of questions. I have a handout here from Mr. Pritchard's organization, if we could hand this out to the committee, just to kind of to show you what, give you an idea of what kind of organization it is and how they operate. I think it just kind of gives you a better understanding of how they are, and then you can see, understand Mr. Pritchard's testimony a little bit better by looking at this. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just say this is a good bill, and this is the right thing to do. So
thank you, Senator Coring, for sharing this with us, because I think it's very important that we understand and learn about the credibility and how the organizations that come to provide testimony actually function.
Madam
I
Chair.
Think that's very important to us. Senator Worgen and Senator Hand, we're going to have to move, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I so wholeheartedly agree with what Senator Hand said. It's not the desire to keep someone away from someone else that they care a great deal about. In the spirit of that, to make this something that I think we can all agree with, I'd like to offer an amendment, if I could, please. On line 1.9, put a period after right to associate and delete designation of domestic partner. And then on 2.8, take out as a domestic partner. And then delete lines 2.13 through the period on 2.17. And insert take out the domestic partner again and insert a designated person may also be identified. And then, Senator Marty, I think we keep everything that you want to do for someone to have someone else with them without losing that.
Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
I have two concerns about that, one of which is who is a designated person? I go to the hospital and say, I'm a designated person. How do you do that? Number two is, again, this assumes that the patient or resident or legal guardian is given the opportunity to designate a person. Again, if they're comatose, they can't designate anyone. And, again, I think the whole point of this is to make it as simple as possible. And, again, the folks involved, people who are partners to each other, who we've decided in statute that are not given the right to marry, have right now they're the same taxpayers we do. They pay the same health insurance we pay. They pay everything the same as we do. They're equal citizens to us, and I frankly think we shouldn't be making any hurdles whatsoever in their ability to visit each other. I think anything that limits that is wrong, and I don't think I can say it more powerfully than Lori said earlier when her partner was dying, and you shouldn't have to fight for that. And I think taking out any of these options does not serve us well that way. And I I think we should just recognize that this is a right for people to visit their loved ones.
Madam Chair.
There is an amendment before. Yes,
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Wardy.
In defense of the amendment, Senator Marty, I'm really not changing the essence of your bill. If your desire is to get domestic partner identified in law, then I would agree with you. You should refuse my amendment. If your desire is to get people to be able to have someone with them what they want, that they want with them when they're critically ill or dying, please accept the amendment.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I don't accept the amendment, but it is a question you have to vote on. But it's simply one that I think domestic partner is, I think people understand what a domestic partner is these days. And again, you can designate whoever you wish to be your family. You have that choice to decide that. And I think that this is an unnecessary amendment, and I think the bill is.
We're going to have to take a vote on the amendment. Senator Johnson has a question.
Thank you. I'd like a roll call on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, Senator Wergen is getting to my concern. The words designee or designated person, I think, opens it up to exactly what you're trying to do. You want someone that cares about you with you. I think that if you use the words domestic partner, you could get into the words themselves being abused in some manner, you know, someone walking in and saying, I'm the domestic partner, when they're not in fact. I'm just thinking that you could get more to what you need by using the word designee.
Clearly, members, the author is in opposition to this amendment, so and Senator Wergen has requested a roll call vote, so we're going to proceed. All of those. Okay, I'm sorry, but we have to proceed with the roll call. Sorry about
Senator
it.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Berglund.
No.
Senator Dahl.
No.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
No.
Senator Fischbach.
Yes.
Senator Hahn.
Yes.
Senator Higgins.
No.
Senator Johnson.
Yes.
Senator Coring.
No.
Senator Lori.
No.
Senator Lynch.
No.
Senator Prentner-Solin? Senator Torres-Ray?
No.
Senator Wergen?
Yes.
Okay, we have four opposed, nine opposed, and four in favor. The amendment does not carry. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill. I believe it's supposed to go to Judiciary.
Okay. All of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Before we, and I just wanted to make a response to my friend, my colleague, Senator Coring, about his comments on the Family Council. And I know that Senator Coring and the Family Council don't share some of the same political views, and they're at odds politically. And but I don't think it's fair to characterize that organization as being in some way dishonest or untruthful or underhanded, because I don't believe they are. There are many organizations that lobby here that disagree with me, that we have very profound political disputes that oppose me in my election, re-election, have contributed money to my opponents and so forth. But I'm not sure that it would be fair to characterize people who disagree with us as being in some way unbelievable or not fit to testify before a committee. And so I just don't think it should stand to say that the character of the organization is one that is not suitable to present testimony to the Senate or a Senate committee.
And Madam Senator Chair. Hahn, I, with all due respect, I will be very offended if an organization actually develops a flyer to come here and attack me on a position on a bill. I think this is really uncalled for. We have positions.
Madam
I
Chair,
think it's important that
isn't. Madam Chair, this is a campaign brochure from last fall's campaign.
And Madam Senator Chair, if I could respond to that, this is a campaign brochure from last fall, and my good friend, and I consider him a friend, Senator Hahn, we disagree on this, because if you look at the brochure, and I'm not trying to prolong this, but if you look at the headline, it says, Senator Paul Coring refuses to vote to protect our children from the promotion of homosexuality in public schools. That's not true. That's not true at all. And so this is the kind of organization this is, and the light needs to be shined on them. And so this is what I need, this is what I intended to do. And so I'm trying to protect our children. And to make a statement like that and to scare my constituents is just plain wrong.
Senators, I apologize, but we're going to have to really move on.
Madam Chair.
We can
Madam
take
Chair.
This after the committee. We have one more bill that we really need to move, and we're not going to talk about campaigns tonight.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fishback and Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I just maybe change the subject completely. I think that this bill, more than anything, points out the need for everyone to have a health care directive. And I think that's what we're really talking about, is making sure, you know, and if I know the gentleman mentioned they were $1,000, but there are less expensive ways to get a hold of them. So I would just say everybody should have one, no matter what your status, whatever, because there's plenty of people that I'm not related to that I'm a healthcare agent for, and we have healthcare directives in that sense. And yes, I know we don't always have them with us, but, you know, have them some way you can get them to the hospital quickly, too. So that's how I want to end this conversation, is everybody go get their health care directive taken care of.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Now I do understand why every time Mr. Pritchard testifies, Senator Coring has somewhat of a reaction to him. And now that I understand, and now that we've had it on the table in this committee, next time Mr. Pritchard comes to the table, I won't forget. Can we not attack him any longer, Ms. Senator Coring?
Okay.
We'll see.
I am sorry. Senator Coring and Senator Johnson, we're going to have to proceed. Senator Marty, you have another bill before to present to the committee. Could you please proceed?
Madam Chair, Senate File 14, we had testimony on about 5 weeks ago. This is we have a delete everything A3 amendment. We had made changes. We had deleted most of the sections of the bill already, and the A3 amendment is one that takes the remaining two sections. It makes a couple of additional changes in them. This is the run on a constitutional right to health care. I believe, as I mentioned previously, that all Minnesotans deserve this right, that our prison inmates have been determined by the U.S. Supreme Court to have this right. I think every one of our constituents deserves the same right. This A3 amendment would change two additional things, one of which is would postpone to the very end of the decade. I think I'd like to have this take effect this decade. The existing bill, the Section 4 of the bill right now would be January of 2010. I'm moving it to the end of 2010 because time is flying. And then number two, Senator Berglund and others have talked about concerns about the word comprehensive in the amendment. I think that both in the bill that we passed out of here and of mine and hers have both talked about a legislative commission working on a developing universal health care plan. What comprehensive means is something would be determined by that group, frankly. So I've taken the word comprehensive out of there. I think this amendment stands on its own. I think it's worth something that Minnesotans deserve, and I like to move the A3 amendment to make those two changes.
Okay. All of those in favor of the amendment? Any questions from committee members?
Chair.
Senator Berglund.
I guess I just have a question in general for Senator Marty. Senator Marty, the last time we heard this bill, I thought that our conversation was leading us to the point where we would hear your constitutional amendment and my constitutional amendment in front of this committee. And I don't see that happening today. So I'm surprised. I'm disappointed. And I don't understand why it's not possible to schedule both of the bills.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, when we last talked, we talked about discussing which one we were going to do. And I indicated later on that I wanted to continue authoring it, that I did understand your concern about the word comprehensive. I think it should be in there, but I think it's appropriate not to. I understood the concern and just wanted to move ahead with it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I guess I kind of agree with Senator Berglund. The committee should have the opportunity to hear both both bills, really. And so I guess, Madam Chair, I would so move to a table Senate File 14, maybe so time that we can work out that we're going to hear both bills. So I would so move to table Senate File 14.
Okay, do I take a vote now?
Madam Chair, I would
Senator
oppose
Hardy?
That motion.
It's not debatable.
It's non-debatable.
Okay. So all of those in favor of tabling this discussion so that we can have a hearing on both Senator Berglund's and Senator Marty's bills, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Aye.
No.
Division.
Okay. Senator Erickson-Ropes, I am not sure about the we're going to have a show of hands.
Mm-hmm.
So those in favor of having a hearing for both, tabling this and having a hearing for both, please show your hand. We have two count for me, please. And then those opposed so that we can hear this today.
Today.
So the other, so the, this motion is just that we hear his bill today.
This was the table.
You can hear hers tomorrow.
We just did it.
So, okay. So Senator Marty will be able to present today.
The motion failed.
The motion failed.
No,
it was not
Madam
tabled.
Chair, I don't know if some of the members know how knew how they were voting. I think
okay.
We need to
let
do,
me repeat
show
that. I hope
hand.
I'm clear on this. There is a
motion
before
the
committee the
bill.
To table this bill so that we can hear this and Senator Berglund's bill together whenever they are scheduled.
Right.
Those who are in favor of that, please show your hands.
3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Those opposed, so that means that we're going to hear Senator Marty's today.
1, 2, 5. The motion is to table Senator Marty's constitutional amendment to a date in the future when we hear both Senator Marty's constitutional amendment and Senator Berglund's constitutional amendment. My vote is to table, and my vote is to continue with Senator Marty's today.
So we had 6 in favor of tabling, and we are now counting the votes to hear the bill from Senator Marty today. So we're going to vote. Who is? Are you ready to vote, Senator Prendergast?
The motion is to table Senator Marty's constitutional amendment.
Okay.
Until the time we hear them both together.
It's not my fault.
So an aye vote is a vote to table, a no vote is a vote to
Madam
table.
Well,
Chair.
Members, you have to be present, really, because this
okay.
is very complicated.
All right. Now
I'm going
to,
we're
going to
have, okay, now that we have everybody here, we're going to vote again.
All right, Madam Chair, do you want me to renew
Senator,
my motion?
Please.
My motion is to table Senate File 14 for today. I think it's important that we hear both bills side by side, and so my motion is to table Senator Marty's Senate File 14 for today.
Okay, so all of those in favor of that motion?
Aye.
No. We have to show your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
No, count me, sorry.
Oh, not counting you?
No, count me.
Sorry.
I was just showing that they have to show their hands. Okay.
No.
Now, those who are opposed, so that means we're going to hear this bill.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6.
So we have a 7-7. Senator Martin.
Did I
is that
seven,
correct?
Seven.
Yes.
So the
7-7.
There are 14
so
of us here.
So the motion fails.
So the motion fails. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14.
So we have a tie.
Okay. So
the motion fails.
Madam
so
Chair, I have a question.
Senator Marty. Yes. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. That was all
this
very
is a
confusing.
Good testimony.
But,
every day is a new learning.
I have actually more of a process question. It just seems to me, and I voted against amendment, but it seems to me that we don't hear all the mental health bills together. We don't hear all the early childhood bills together. We don't hear all the affordable health care bills together. We're late for today. That's true. But It seems to me that if we're going to move to a model where we put all the same subject bills together, is that what we're doing? Or We've never done it that way before, where we've required same subject bills to be heard side by side. So,
Senator Erickson Robes, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't chair this committee. So,
Madam
Senator Worgen.
I'm going to apologize, Senator Marty. My vote was based a lot on the time. It's 3:20, and I've made several other appointments this afternoon, so I'm going to have to go.
Senator Marty, would you like to proceed and just present your bill?
I would like to proceed, but I understand the time. I have no witnesses, nothing else. We've already discussed the entire bill. I'll move the bill.
Okay. All of those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Close to the floor, too.